Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. In studio with me today is Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. And are there still vegetables to be taken care of? Yes, there is.
There are a few things that we need to do, and there are a few things that we need to clean up, and there are things that we should be planning for. So I think we have a few things to talk about today.
Well, we want people to call in or go online or send an email with their question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and, of course, like us while you're there, and then post your question or comment there as well. Okay, so I'm...
Well, let me ask you a question, though. Let me ask the question. It's pledge week this week, right?
Yes.
I understand. So should we get some people to call in because, you know, they feel like it's important for them to not only learn something about their vegetable garden, but also support us? Here at Utah Public Radio?
Well, of course, we would love that, but we won't make your question or comment contingent on leaving it.
Well, I didn't know if we were going to do that or not. You know, if you want some advice, it was going to cost you today. Maybe we could go that route. I don't think that will work. So why don't you just call in with a good question, that something you've seen this summer that kind of has perplexed you, or something that you would like to try, or something that just is... tied to your vegetable garden, and we will address it today. So use the call-in number, 1-800-826-1495.
Ooh, you've got it memorized.
I do. I mean, I know. Even, I was looking at it to my back. I just had to pull it out of the old digital memory bank. So please call in. I really hate listening to myself talk the whole time, and I'd much prefer to interact with some of our listeners out in the state and tell me how the things went this year. I mean, it was an unusual summer. And now that we're into kind of getting fat and sassy, and as we sit back and think about the winter coming ahead of us and enjoying the fruits of our labor, so to speak, from the vegetable garden, it's time to ask those questions so that you can be better at something next year.
Well, I'll start out with something. So, okay. And we've already discussed this before the program, but I thought it might be interesting for the listeners. We've talked about cover crops on our program before. So I'm driving by on 8th. East, you called it the student garden?
Yeah, the student organic farm.
Okay, and they had what looked like some kind of grain that was growing, and you said it is?
Well, they plant a combination cover crop for the winter, which is going to be the base for some of their nutrient requirements for next year. They plant winter wheat, and they intersperse that with hairy vetch. And both of those are cover crops that we've talked about in the past, and they have two unique properties that are kind of separate from each other. First of all, the winter wheat, the nice thing about it is that we find that it is fairly vigorous in its growth here in the autumn. It tends to grow at a lower temperature and has a faster growth rate, and that's good for the vegetable garden, or for this case, the organic farm, in that any nutrients that are still kind of floating around in the soil get absorbed by the winter wheat and stored there for use next year. And so in the spring, the students will come in, they'll mow down that winter wheat, then they'll incorporate it and disc it in or rotivate it into the soil, and that then becomes the basis for some of the nutrients that the plants are going to use next year. Then what they also do is they put hairy vetch in it, and hairy vetch, the good thing about it is very winter hardy, but it grows really slow in the autumn, so it may not get very big, and then when the spring comes, it really kicks into gear and grows vigorously, and it is a nitrogen fixer. So it takes atmospheric nitrogen and converts it into plant usable nitrogen. So that then becomes a source for leaf growth, because the main nutrient that many plants need is nitrogen, and that's the one that's most limiting in our vegetable gardens. And we often supplement it through the addition of urea or ammonium sulfate or some kind of granular fertilizer that has nitrogen in it. And the hairy vetch tends to do that for us. It takes stuff from the air, the nitrogen that's in the air, and fixes it into tissue, the rhizobia that's there in the soil also utilize that, make that conversion for us. But when we incorporate the vetch into the soil, it starts to break down and all that nitrogen is released. And in fact, it often can produce sufficient nitrogen to get your vegetable garden up and going and probably carry on throughout most of the growing season and provide plenty of nitrogen over time. And so that's a really nice way of doing it. It stabilizes the soil as well. So we got cover there. So when the winter winds come and the rain comes and all these other things, we don't get soil erosion. So that's a good thing.
So you don't worry about the deer coming through
and
they
may,
munching it
but
down.
You know, I look at deer as both a blessing and a curse. The blessing is that when they're eating the grass that's there, they might be depositing little pellets of use to us, you know, so they're basically eating it and they're actually making manure that can be used in the garden. So that's the blessing part, if you want to look at it that way. The curse part is that oftentimes they eat the stuff and then they go someplace else and deposit their manure. And as a result, we lose some things. But, you know, you can't do much always about the deer. In fact, we've had some problems, I understand, up in North Logan and stuff where people have been shooting deer illegally in the city where you can't do that. And there was one that had an arrow in it that was living, and it was the DNR people had to put it down because it was, you know, impacted by that. So, you know, that's a sad thing when you see that, those types of things. And there's a lot of people that like them. Certainly the students at the organic farm tell me they don't like them because they come in and do a tremendous amount of damage as they walk through, and they take a bite out of this and a bite out of that, and they're not so considerate as to say, oh, I like that, I'll just eat the whole thing. They seem to graze, and that's what ungulates do. So,
well, I noticed that you can always tell in the spring where they've been on my the grass of my parents' home. I don't get them so much at my house, but in River Heights, there's a green patch here and a green patch there. And so, yeah. I mean, it's nitrogen.
Yeah, they are providing some of that to it. So, you know, it can be useful, but, you know, I think in the whole, they tend to do more harm than good to us. And I'm trying to put a positive spin on it. Preferably, I'd like to see them be someplace else. But we are in their winter range as well, and now we have a resident range that they don't even move back to the mountains anymore. Yeah. They just stay out here, and so they don't even follow their old historic pattern of movement. So that's just an aside.
So this combination of doing the winter wheat and the vetch, is that something you've been doing for the last couple of years, or just
at the student farm? That has been part of the regime that Dr. Reeve has worked with the students on, kind of coming up with combinations that are useful. I've got research work that we're looking at winter wheat by itself, hairy vetch by itself, and then we also seed in the fall a hardy winter kale, a Siberian kale. And the kale itself is edible. It's a vegetable that you could consume, but the brassica species produce these compounds when you incorporate them that break down into cyanide-based compounds, they are. That are suppressive to weeds, are suppressive to fungi, are suppressive to nematodes, and some of the other harmful pathogens and insects that we see in commercial production sites. And as a result of that, we're looking at exploring the impact and the effect of different cover cropping combinations on vegetable growth in the following year. So I've got my cover crops planted. My Siberian kale is up about 6 inches tall right now. We planted that the first week of September. And then it will kind of go dormant for the winter, and it'll just sit there. And then next spring, it'll start to grow again. And just about that time, it starts to flower because it gets enough cold temperature to flower. And then we'll just till it into the soil. And then that becomes the basis for cycling nutrients, but also for providing some of these other effects that can help suppress weeds, suppress diseases, suppress some insects that could theoretically be problems in farming situations or in gardening situations. And so those approaches are ones that we're trying to explore and help our organic farmers make correct choices. And then later on in the spring and the summer, what we do with those sites is we also plant like another legume, a summer bean. We plant a grass like a millet, or we plant another, some buckwheat in the summer, which like to grow then. And then what we're doing is also kind of feeding the system throughout the year in an attempt to create an environment that's favorable for our vegetables.
So how does this not affect the vegetables? So if you're suppressing weeds, is it the seeds or is it the plant?
It's the plant itself. And that's one of the concerns that one has is that you may find that some plants are suppressed by the cover crop that you grow, and we've been careful in our selection so that we, A, either don't produce so much biomass that it's suppressive, or that we allow sufficient time after we incorporate it where it doesn't have a suppressive effect. And so ideally with a cover crop, what you tend to do is plant it, let it grow for a period of time, incorporate it, and then allow the soil to sit for a period of time to allow it to start to decompose so that it doesn't suppress the crop that we grow. And so we're finding that if you give it sufficient time, generally somewhere between 10 days and 2 weeks after incorporation, and then you plant, you find that there's very little suppressive characteristics with some of these cover crops. And so they do work well. Many of our organic farmers do them already. And certainly in our home vegetable gardens, rather than just leaving your residue vegetable matter out in the garden all winter and then next spring coming along and figuring, oh, I've got to get rid of those tomato vines and I've got that corn stalks and I've got this and that still sitting out there that I have to do something with. We often advocate that you incorporate that in the fall. It allows it to break down. You maybe put some cover crop out there and then you use that and incorporate it again next spring. And then that helps to add organic matter to our soils. It also helps to improve water holding capacity. It helps with drainage. It helps with the nutrient status of it. And it can also suppress some diseases and some insects that can give us problems. And so there's just so many positive things about using cover crops that more gardeners need to be thinking about using them.
If you want to do a no-till method. I know there's kind of a movement for that. How do you use cover crops with no-till? Because the idea is you plant them in and you want to incorporate it back into the soil.
Well, the idea of non-tillage means exactly what it says. We don't do any incorporation. We leave the residue of the cover crop right on the surface. Now, the problem comes with the type of cover crop that you're growing and using in the garden. If you use something like a winter wheat, it wants to continue to grow through the fall. It goes a little bit dormant during the winter when the temperatures are too cold for growth to occur, and then next spring it resumes growth. And so then it becomes a competitor with the crops that we want to plant. And so in many no-till situations, farmers that are using winter wheat or winter rye as their cover crop often have to come in with some type of method to kill the winter rye or the winter wheat. And some of them find that if the plant is just beginning to put up its seed stalk and they roll it over and kind of mash it down, that tends to stop its growth. But that doesn't work so well, so they resort to using herbicides. And there's many gardeners that don't want to use herbicides, and I can understand that. So that might not be the best type of cover crop to use. So you could switch over to vetch. And the nice thing about hairy vetch is that if you mow it in the springtime when it gets to a certain above a certain height, it will effectively stop its growth and it won't regrow. So it's a nitrogen fixer. Alfalfa is a nitrogen fixer. If you mow alfalfa, it regrows, but vetch doesn't do that. And so what many of the gardeners and the organic farmers do that grow vetch is they let it get up to a certain height, and then they go in with a mower and cut it very close to the soil surface, and that kills it. And then they leave it on the surface, and then they plant into that. A third option is to plant oats. And so the oat plant is not winter hardy, so they sow that in mid-September. It grows in the autumn until we get some very hard freezes, and it takes about 25 degrees to kill it. So it would stay green right in through October and into early November, and then the cold weather comes, freezes the growing point, kills the plant, and the residue stays on the surface. And then in the following spring, you can do one of two things. You can till out the section that you need to plant in and leave the rest of it on the surface, or you just go back in and transplant into those areas. And that's one way to accomplish a similar type of a no-till type of production system. And the oats do a lot of the same thing that wheat does. The only difference is that it generally winter kills. Now, you have to be careful with oats because there are some that are more winter hardy than others. So you have to kind of research a little bit and select a variety that isn't very winter hardy, and then that works quite well for you.
I don't remember the exact variety that I had, but about 8-9 years ago, I planted some oats. And they didn't all die.
That's right.
The spring came, and yeah. I'm noticing green spears coming up, and like these leaves.
Yeah,
okay,
that's unusual. And so
it wasn't a lot. It killed most of them.
Yeah, most of them will die because they're not winter hardy. But there are some that are more winter hardy than others. And for the most part, with oats, it's a good one to plant in the fall. And if you are really you have to be careful because when you plant like winter wheat or barley or something like that, those are or rye, all of those are somewhat winter hardy, and so they're going to grow again next spring.
Especially if you get a deep snow cover, yeah, that's going to insulate them.
You have to change your practices, or you have to rethink your practices. And if you aren't opposed to using herbicides or something like that, Roundup does a very effective job of killing them out. And lots of gardeners use Roundup in their gardens, and it kills everything it comes into. So you kill out what you want to kill out, and you leave what you want to leave. And I work with a few commercial farmers, and what they do is they plant winter wheat or winter rye, and then they just till out strips where they're going to plant their vegetables, and they leave it in the other areas, and it creates a good windbreak for them. Because most of us know that in the springtime we get winds, and that's hard on plants. It's hard on moving soil. And, we saw the dust storms the other week. We went to California, came across Nevada, and all it was dust from one end of Nevada to the other. And it was just horrible. I mean, all that soil moving someplace out that you don't want it. And some would say that the soil in Nevada is not that good anyway, but it's just to see so much movement lends ourselves to saying to gardeners, this is one way to conserve a resource that's limited. There's only so much soil that's there. It takes a long time to make more soil because it's just broken down organic matter and other things and weathered rock and those types of things. And it takes time. And we live in short time spans relative to soil time spans. So, kind of conserving that resources and trying to do things to build it up through the use of cover crops, through the use of compost, through the use of manure additions. All of those things are helpful to our soils, and that's going to mean that they produce crops that are helpful for us.
Well, we'd like to hear from you. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Or you can go online and send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your comment there. So with the cover crops, if you decide to leave it in, I'm assuming, because usually what I've tended to do is I get all the leaves in the neighborhood I possibly can, dump them on the garden, and I've got maybe a foot and a half, and then I have someone, and then I put nitrogen on that, yep. And then I have someone come in and till it.
Yep.
Is one method better than another? I've got winter pea is going in this year, so yep. I won't be tilling.
Right.
So is it better to do a green manure versus the brown?
Well, it can be and it cannot be. I mean, some of the things that one needs to be concerned about with the cover crops are, can you manage them in the springtime? Can you get them incorporated? And more people are hiring someone to come in with a rototiller on a tractor, and that's a very effective way of doing it. It quickly preps your garden. It doesn't cost really that much to have somebody do them, and it certainly saves a lot of time and back pain by getting your garden ready for you. And so that incorporates both of those things, a cover crop or all that brown waste, quite efficiently. With the brown waste, like you say, the problem with leaves and such is that there's not much nitrogen in them. There's lots of other things in them, but there's not much nitrogen. So what you're doing is you're adding a nutrient, the fertilizer, the nitrogen fertilizer, to encourage the bacteria to break down all of that cellulitic material, that which is what the leaves have. And so you need to supply something to that. The green manures, like the wheat and the hairy vetch, tend to provide all of those things already by themselves. And what they're doing is they're soaking up additional nutrients that are in the soil and binding them and keeping them in place so that they don't wash deeper into the soil profile. So there's that benefit from a green manure that you cannot get from a brown type of manure, which is your leaves or something like that. And so both of them are useful. Now, the one thing with leaves that one needs to be concerned about is that some leaves can produce compounds that are not healthy in the garden. So if you have lots of pine-based leaves and needles that you're putting in there, sometimes that creates a too acid type environment. Now, under our conditions here in the West, where our soil pHs are quite high in the 7 to 8 pH range, adding in an acid-based plant material doesn't hurt you that much, because the soil has such a huge buffering capacity that you can't change the pH very much. In the eastern United States or something like that, that might be a problem for you, where the pHs are much lower and you actually can lower it even further, and so you'll have to do something to correct that. The second thing that we see with some of these brown materials is I have a black walnut in my backyard, and walnuts, all walnuts produce some compounds that are toxic to other plants. And so we really don't ever like to compost our walnut leaves, even though it produces copious quantities of them. I wouldn't use those in my vegetable garden. And I've had people, when I put the bags out for the city to pick up to compost, that it's okay they get composted because there's such a small proportion of all other leaves, so that the effect is minute, and it's probably not doing any harm. But I've had a few people come along and go, oh, there's bags there. They grab all the bags, and now they've got a pure concentrated, you know, walnut mulch that they're putting down, which could create problems for them. And so, you know, you need to kind of be thinking about those things. The rest of the types of trees that we grow, whether it's a linden or whether it's a maple or whatever, a fruit tree, that an apple or something like that, you know, those don't produce compounds that are, you know, very toxic to our plants. And so the benefit of your brown waste is a good thing. And so you just have to make those decisions for yourself. And certainly composting these things, you're trying to compost them in the vegetable garden and then incorporate them, or you can generate compost piles out of them. But most people don't like to do those because they don't refuse to turn them, and they refuse to encourage them to compost like they're supposed to. It's just too much work. So they go out and buy compost from, you know, Miller's or one of the other places, and try to circumvent that process. And so I don't know. I'm kind of always torn between what one should do and what one shouldn't do. And you should do things that are enjoyable to you. You should do things that understand why you're doing what you're doing,
and that you'll see all the way through.
And that you'll see through. Yeah. And if you do those things, then you have a really good resource that you can use for many, many years. And, you know, certainly if we went in and looked at your vegetable garden, I think we would see, because of the things that you've done over the years, that you have a garden that you can get into early in the spring, and you can plant early.
Usually.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are always exceptions, but for the most part, you have soil now that is greatly enriched because you have done the things that needed to be done to enrich it, rather than just relying on, I'm going to go to one of my fertilizer stores and buy some type of fertilizer to provide the nutritive need to the plant.
It's definitely easier for me now than it was 17 years ago when I moved in.
And that just reinforces the fact that, you know, to change soil takes time. And most of us think, well, we live in an age where we get instantly gratified by everything that in the garden, it takes time, and you just need to understand that you're going to change your soil, that you better be in it for the long haul.
But it's also knowing what kind of soil you've got, because if in River Heights, I would never have really any compacted soil
right.
at all. There's
right.
there's enough gravel and rocks and everything in there that it pretty well stays somewhat loose. But if I didn't till in the fall or have a cover crop of some kind to keep the soil loose with
yeah.
the
yep.
in the spring, I'd have to go over it 3 or 4 times with my little tiller just to try to get everything loosened
up. Yeah. And that's has so much to do, and we talk about soil types, and you know, it actually the addition of the organic matter, regardless of whether it comes from green matter or brown matter, you know, is doing that and is helping do that for you, because as those organisms break that material down, you see that organic material being adhered to the particles that are in the soil, the clay particles and the silt particles or the sand particles, and they create a way for there to be adhesion, so how they bind together, but also so that they will crumble and break apart so that you can do the things that you need to do, provided, of course, that you're not trying to work ground when it's too wet.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here, and we'll have Petals and Pros toward the end of the program. But right now, be thinking of your questions that you can call in with. We're going to move into talking about, okay, how do you take care of your squash, and how to cure them and put them indoors and so forth. So those will be the questions that we'll be answering coming up, or ask any question you'd like. 800-826-1495. Or online, zestygarden@gmail.com or the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. So stay with us.
Fall is here, and that means it's time to harvest and select the perfect pumpkin for your garden or Halloween display. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. And whether you grew the pumpkin yourself or are visiting a pick-your-own farm, follow these tips to find the best possible pumpkin. Start by harvesting pumpkins when the rind is firm and glossy and the spot touching the ground is cream to orange in color. Leave the stem intact when harvesting pumpkins to extend their longevity. And always carry the fruit by cradling it in your arms, not by the stem. Select pumpkins free of holes, cuts, and soft spots. Damaged fruit tends to rot faster and is sure to ruin the fall display. Store your pumpkins in a cool location until you're ready to break out the knives and start cutting. Extend the life of carved pumpkins by washing them with warm water and letting them dry before you start carving. Coat the cuts with petroleum jelly to further extend the life and beauty of carved pumpkins. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
North in Logan
on Utah Public
Celebrating
Radio
is made possible in part by our members and Global Village Gifts at 69 East 100 North in Logan, celebrating Fair Trade Month, raising awareness of the reasons fair trade is important by offering socially and commercially sustainable fair trade products. Details at globalvillagegifts.org. Support also comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where graduates' acceptance rates to medical, dental, and graduate schools exceed national averages. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information at usu.edu/science.
Welcome back to the second half of The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost, USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, is my guest. And, okay, I'm not going to sound really pleading here, but yeah, we'd really like to have your phone call.
I hate it when I have to talk all the time. You know, I can talk.
We do have a
me.
Caller. Who is it? Oh, great. Tim in Providence. Hi, Tim.
Well.
Thanks
hey,
for the call.
I was driving down the road just now and heard your discussion about walnut leaves. And as one who has picked up bags of leaves from Dan's curb in the past, I had an experience to relate. I got them home, spread them on the garden, realized they were black walnut. I diluted them with regular leaves, tilled them in, And the next spring, we had a couple walnut saplings growing.
Yeah.
So I dug them up, and this has probably been about 4 or 5 years ago, but ended up transplanting it. It's now growing in a friend's front yard in Providence. So,
well, that's
there
great.
Was a good ending.
Yeah. Well, you know, my sister-in-law usually comes around, and she has a black walnut cake that her grandmother used to make with some degree of regularity. And so she made that for us last year. And so I'm saving her a few to make some black walnut cake again for me for one of these Sunday afternoons where we can sit around and eat cake and talk about our grandparents and the good things that they did for us, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there is some merit to having these. And hopefully your garden didn't have too much ill effects by having that compost put on there from the black walnut.
No, it didn't appear to, only because I had put so many other maple and other leaves on it.
Yeah,
but,
good.
We made lemonade out of the lemons there.
Yeah, so well, that's the smart thing to do. So
that.
Great.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks
okay,
for the comments.
Have a good day, you guys.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. So we got to make sure we talk about how to cure your squash, because that's the question I'm getting the most right now. How do you take care of your squash?
Well, you know, the sad part of it is, as I drive around, I still see some squash out in people's gardens, and that's always kind of gives me a little bit of heartburn.
And especially with the frost that we had.
And that's the reason I'm concerned. I don't care about pumpkins. I mean, you know, they're going to sit out on your front step. You're going to carve them with your children. You know, you're not going to really use them for anything other than a display. So getting frost on the pumpkin isn't problematic. But frost on the banana squash, frost on the Hubbards, frost on
my little bonbons, turbans.
That's right. Yeah. The turbans, frost on the butternuts, frost on the buttercups. You know, those are a problem. And the reason it's a problem is that those plants like warmer weather. They grow in the warmest times of the year. They do their flowering and fruit set and growth in the warmer time of the year. And when you get a frost event on them, you do a little bit of damage to those cells that are the frost sits on. And then the flavor compounds, you get off flavors that occur in those particular areas. Plus, you get some cells that are broken down, and you'll get some rots that occur in storage and those kinds of things. And so really, we like to harvest squash and stuff for storage, you know, before we get a hard freeze on them. And we've had some hard freezes up here in Cache County. Now, if you're in an area where it hasn't frozen yet, you're okay. But in the valley, we've had them. In Brigham City, they've had them. In Ogden, they've had them. Even down into Layton, they've had them.
Well, and I was in Salt Lake yesterday, noticed along the curb where somebody had squash, it was frosted.
Yeah, so those squashes are going to be injured, and as a result of that, that impacts how well they will store this winter. And so you need to, what we normally would recommend with squash is that they harvest them before a frost, then that you put them down someplace where it's warm to cure them.
So warm meaning?
And by warm, we mean temperatures that are, you know, at room temperature or above. So I'm not talking about 40 degrees or 50 degrees curing temperature. We're talking about something like around 65 to 75 degree curing temperatures. And what that does is it helps harden the skin further, and it also helps to start to the process of converting some of the starches that are in the flesh to sugars, so that your flavors are better. And then once they're cured, generally curing time is anywhere from 10 days to 2 weeks, then they can be stored at somewhere around 50 to 60 degrees. So oftentimes many of us will put them down in our basements, and they put them in their fruit storage area which is cold, and it's too cold again for those squashes, and as a result they take on off flavors. I tend to store mine in or near the furnace area because it's quite a bit warmer in that section of your basement. And as a result, the squash will store well into, you know, the winter months, and often we'll be eating our squash, you know, up until March
or even early April.
It's great to have them that late.
It is wonderful to have them that way.
When I was talking to my neighbor, and he's like, you still got squash? This was early April. He says, you still got squash?
Yeah.
He says, yeah, we have the turban variety, right. the buttercups. And a lot of it depends on the variety, of course, the type of squash. But those buttercups last forever.
Forever. Yeah.
And they'll just, we just have them lined up along in our furnace area, lined up along the floor and just sitting there, and they do great.
Yeah, and if you have them in your cold room, so to speak, in the basement, what you'll find is that those cells that had been damaged out in the cold outside start to break down, and then the secondary pathogens come in, and you'll get black molds and blue molds and all kinds of things that go on. And so that is storage loss that you're trying to avoid. And so you're forced to, nothing wrong with those, you just have to cut that part out and use them. But they come on so fast because there's so much disease in there that you tend to go, oh, I've got all these squash that are going bad on me. And so you just kind of throw up your hands and you can't consume them. Whereas if you can keep them stored properly and condition them properly, then you'll have them well into March and April. And that's really quite nice because there really isn't anything as nice as a roasted squash. I mean, we roast, I was just thinking of that. I was thinking, the weather's getting cold enough and some roasted squash and a roast and, some roasted potatoes with it and throw some onion in there and I can just almost taste it right now.
Okay, so we've got 5 minutes left. So we need to talk about potatoes. You just mentioned potatoes.
Yep.
Don't put them in your cold storage.
Actually, potatoes...
Or do they go cold?
They do better cold, but, it's kind of... There's trade-offs. You have to remember that potatoes store starch, and we want them to be starchy. And if we put them in the coldest part of our cold room, what happens is... The potato actually converts starches to sugars, and you'll get them. They start to get sweeter than you think. And so we can kind of reverse those processes. What the commercial guys do is they store them really cold, so they build up some sugars. But then as they start to think about marketing them, they start to warm up the facility so that they're now at temperatures of around 40 to 50, and then you'll get conversion of the sugars back to starch so that they have that starchy flavor. Hmm. But they store better at colder temperatures, but we will just pull them out and use them. So you can store them cold if you don't mind them a little on the sweeter side, but it's better to store them somewhere around 45 degrees, and then they stay in a more starchy type of flavor that's in the tuber itself.
Onions?
Cold? Onions cold. Yeah, you want to store them really cold. So right around the freezing part, and I always put mine in my garage because it doesn't freeze, but it's really close to zero, and then they'll stay until May as well.
To zero? You mean 32?
32. I always talk in Celsius. I'm sorry. I'm a scientist. Yeah, I think in Celsius. 0 degrees Celsius, 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Carrots and parsnips and cabbage. I'd say leave them out in the garden.
Carrots and parsnips and leave them in the garden for sure. Just throw some mulch over the top of them because if the ground freezes, it gets harder to dig them. So, you put some bagged leaves on them on top of them, put a lot of straw on that or something, that's good. If you have cabbage, one of two things. You can leave them in the garden for a while here until the snow flies. It doesn't hurt them any. They just get sweeter, and that's always a good thing. Or you can do the old approach my father used to do is dig a trench, pull up the cabbage, turn it upside down with all the leaves on it, throw soil back in the trench, and just leave the roots sticking up so you know where that is. And then when you want one, just go pull it up. And
it was so good.
They are so sweet. When in January, February, March, I just remember, they are just the
best.
If
you didn't think you liked cabbage, you need to try it
this way. You will love them this way. So, yeah. I mean, it's a little bit extra work,
but it's well worth it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Dan, thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. It's been fun again.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. And we'll have to see next month if we have anything going.
Well,
it might be January
before we come back. It might be January before we get back. So
All right.
A couple weeks off wouldn't hurt us.
Well, thanks for spending some time with us this year. And coming up next is Petals and Pros. And then we'll be back next week. for the Zesty Garden. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. It's Nancy Williams with the Zesty Garden and Petals and Prose. I'm going to read you another piece of Sue Hubbell's book, A Country Year. The book was written by a remarkable woman, a 50-year-old ex-librarian and survivor of an unsettling divorce, a beekeeper and self-taught naturalist living alone in the Missouri Ozarks. It's a magical book called Elegant and Lovely by Peter Matthiessen, Enchanting and Engrossing by Lewis Thomas, and it's been compared to Aldo Leopold's 1949 classic, A Sand County Almanac. In essays as fresh and entrancing as the wilderness they describe, Sue Hubbell testifies to the wholeness and serenity available to those who live in, quote, an untrimmed state, unquote. One of those essays is about her fine party at the South Central Missouri Beekeeper's annual pig roast, which is a mouthful. She says, "We have it on my place each year in July because I have space enough in back under the big oak trees for the 70 people who usually come, and also because I am the only one in the group who lives on a river and they like to have a place to swim. I asked the commander of the VFW post ahead of time, and he always gives permission for the beekeepers and their families to use the beach down there on that Sunday. One of our members is both a pig farmer and a beekeeper, and it is he who donates the pig. He comes in the morning to get the fire started. He arranges a circle of stones and concrete blocks out in the open away from the trees and builds up a big fire of oak and hickory logs from my woodpile. While I helped him with it last Sunday, he grumbled to me about all the charcoal factories that are springing up around here. They're bringing in money for our woodcutters, but he is an Ozarker born and bred, and he said he didn't like them turning our forests into charcoal briquettes so that people who lived in fancy suburbs all over the country could cook on an open fire. By the time the fire had burned down to a proper pig roasting stage, some of the other beekeepers and their families had arrived. It was still a few degrees below the 100 predicted by the weatherman, and those who had driven out from town and the slight breeze up here on my hilltop made it all seem a bit cooler. Early in the morning, I had set up 2 sawhorses under the oak trees and put a 4x8 slab of plywood across them. I threw a bedspread over the top as a tablecloth and stood back to look. It seemed inadequate preparation for a large party, and the table seemed a little bare, so I walked out into the field and picked an armful of Queen Anne's lace, black-eyed Susans, daisies, and butterfly weed, and put them in a bottle of water as a centerpiece. The beekeepers arrived, and their wives began to unpack their baskets. They filled my refrigerator and put out on the table the food that would not be spoiled by the heat. There were casseroles, salads made fresh from the garden, a basket of newly picked peaches from a home orchard. One wife had been butchering and freezing her flock of chickens the week before and had saved a couple to fry for us. We all agreed that chickens which are allowed to run and forage some of their own food always taste better than the kind you buy from the grocery store. There were homemade pickles and relishes, lemonade and iced tea and coolers, pies and cakes that had just been taken from the oven on this hot day. I'm not much of a cook, so my contribution is always a washtub full of cold beer and ice. There are some teetotalers among the beekeepers, and they had objected to the beer the first year that we had the pig roast. But they come back each time, so I guess they worked out some kind of accommodation with their principals. An interest in bees brings the group together, and some of us are friends for other reasons, too. But it's a mixed gathering, ranging not only from teetotalers to beer drinkers, but various in other ways as well. 2 men are in their 80s and have kept bees all their lives, but there are also young people who have just discovered the pleasures of beekeeping. There are back-to-the-landers with shoulder-length hair and earnest manners, longtime Ozark farmers, the town banker, some school teachers, and several carpenters. There are retired couples who have now got time for a few hives of bees. I am the only commercial beekeeper, the only one who makes my living from it and has a lot of hives. Most of them have a hive or 2. A few have 10 or 20. Most of them are men. Nearly all of the women are wives who take an interest in what their husbands like to do. The children were eager to go swimming as soon as they arrived, so their parents took them down to the river after they'd unpacked the food. Everyone had brought folding lawn chairs, and we set them up in a big circle under the oak trees near the table. Those who didn't go swimming sat gossiping and talking bees. Some people came back from the river, cool and wet, and others went down while some of us stayed behind to watch the fire and turn the pig meat. A few of the new beekeepers had never seen my honey house and were curious about it, so I took them out there, demonstrated the machinery, and showed them how everything worked. By the middle of the afternoon, the pig was done, and we were all hungry. The women brought the rest of the food out from the refrigerator and arranged it on the table, and we ate as much as we could and then sat in the chairs and talked while the children played. By sunset, the temperature had dropped a little, and the wives cleaned up the leftover food. Some of the men carried the plywood and sawhorses back to the barn for me. Families with young children began to leave, but others stayed on. We sat under the oak trees in the dusk and watched the fireflies rising up from the grass, wondering why you never saw them in the daytime. We talked about how the price of honey was falling and the cost of bee equipment was rising. In the distance, the whippoorwills started calling, and I lost the thread of the talk, listening for the odd call among them that I've been hearing lately. I think that it may be a Chuck Wills widow, but I don't know birdsong well enough to be sure, so I interrupted the conversation to ask if any of the others knew. As it turned out, there were none among the group who knew bird calls, but everyone stopped to listen and could tell the difference in the call when I pointed it out. We also could hear the katydids and the cicadas all around us, and we talked about them for a while and how they made their sounds with their bodies. Then we talked about how poorly the government price support program was working for small beekeepers. It was late and cool when my guests decided it was time to go home. A gibbous moon lit the way to their pickups, and there were fireflies everywhere. We agreed that it had been one of our better pig roasts. One little boy had cried when my rooster chased him. But other than that, everyone had had a good time. This is Nancy Williams for Petals and Prose.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.